Please give her a warm welcome, Susie O from Menifee.
Hi everyone.
Hi.
I'm Susie O from Menifee, Grateful Al-Anon.
Nice to meet you.
I'm just going to pray for myself right now, you know, just God taking over. Thank you. Okay, so how exciting is it to be here today? I am so excited. I thank you, Tammy and Kelly. I have felt so loved and welcomed here. You know, it's just been a blessing to get to know Tammy. Like she said, we went to the women's retreat out here in Cambria, and I never doubt that anything that happens in my life is a coincidence. It's always by design. So with that, thank you. Thank you for my cookies, my socks, and all the loving gifts that I received. I just want to start out by saying this family speakers last night, yesterday, were so wonderful, Perla and Robert. You know, it was meant for me to hear her. She had a lot of things that I identified with. Felt like an aunt to me out there. You know, sharing what she shared about, you know, being with a Hispanic macho guy that was my first husband. And it was just a blessing to hear their family recovery. And it reminds me that we do recover, and especially from, you know, things that we don't talk about with others outside of our programs. And then I want to also give another shout out to Alonzo, because, you know, looks can be deceiving, and I was like, well, let's see what this guy got, you know, and I hear him, and I just was like identifying for my husband. You know, that's what Al-Anons do. I was identifying, saying, oh gosh, man, like he must have really related to him. His story were very similar, you know, the kind of things that they like to partake in. And then we get in line, we get up to the front, and my husband introduces himself, and he says, the dog story. You know, that was it for him, the dog story. So I needed to identify that as my disease. You know, I'm thinking about what my husband needs to hear, not what I need to hear. You know, and I'll tell myself another story. You know, it's been so wonderful to be here. We're in our hotel room this morning. You know, I'm in my prayer meditation, and I see a line of Pepsi cans, and I said, wow, babe, you got like 6 cans here. And he looks at me, and he said, are you supposed to be counting my drinks? You know, I'm still affected by the disease of alcoholism. It's a constant reminder that I need to work on myself. So what's it like? What happened, and how it is today? So I grew up in a little town right outside of LA. I grew up in a very big Hispanic household. I was number 6 of 7 children. I like to think that I was important in the family, but being 6, number 7 came really quick after me, and immediately I knew I wasn't in that line in the pecking order. I was kind of the forgotten child, I felt like. And that was, I think I could remember such early feelings like from 4 or 5 years old. Although we grew in a, you know, I had loving and fun siblings, you know, and if you talk to them today, we all had different experiences, very different experiences, you know. My father was, I believe he was an alcoholic, and, you know, my oldest sister, who was 14 years older than me, she had a different father. By time, you know, I was at the age that I remember and had memories, my father was already full on in his disease. And that was about 14 years of the progression of alcoholism. And I won't get too much into details about my childhood, but I did want to share how my life has been set up from early experiences. So my father, my grandparents died, they were given some money, and my dad bought a cabin out in Joshua Tree. And every holiday, my dad would take us out there from Labor Day, and we would stay to Memorial Day. We never go out there after that. It's too hot. And there was a time where we would all be outside, you know, stargazing. There was hardly any light pollution. And we would sit around the stars, and my dad would always be drinking. And we had a bed of cactuses. And one of my early memories is just wanting to have my dad's love. And he's drinking, and I'm trying to climb on him and get on top and, you know, to sit on his lap, you know. But he's drinking with his brother. And I remember that I just wanted to be loved. I wanted to feel love. And I grabbed him, and he didn't hold me. And I turned around, I fell down. And I landed on what looked like today, like barrel cactuses, real spiny. And so they went through both of my hands. I remember we were 45 minutes into town to a nearest hospital. My hands were bleeding. You know, and we got to the hospital. They, you know, bandaged me up. And the whole weekend, my brother and sister made fun of me, you know, because both my hands were bandaged up. You know, and that's the kind of house that I grew up in. We didn't talk about feelings. We talked, we made fun of people. We didn't, you know, I was never asked how I felt, never received the comfort from my mother. She was too busy with the other seven children. And so I grew up kind of fending for myself. When I was 7 years old, my dad was in a car accident. And he was on the 605 freeway and the 5 coming home from work, coming from the bar, I found out later in life. And he was, this was before there was a retaining wall. And he flipped over the side of the freeway, and by the grace of God, someone heard some trees cracking behind their yard. Back then, there wasn't a lot of lights or anything, and a neighbor kind of heard it and went outside and saw my dad's car flipped upside down, and they called the paramedics. And when they got my dad to the hospital, he was clinically dead. He had internal injuries, brain injury, and I remember getting my mom getting the call, and my mom taking us over to the neighbor's house to watch all seven children while she goes to the hospital. And a few days after that, we were taken to the hospital. And, you know, and a lot of this information was just more filtered through feelings, hearing my other siblings, what's going on with my parents. Never once did my mom explain to us what happened, what was happening. And she, my mom took us to the hospital, and I remember seeing my dad behind the room. He had the ventilator on, and all us kids went into the room. Now, I just remember the nurse pushing us in the room to go in there, and I don't understand why, or at the time, I didn't understand what we were supposed to be doing. And today I know is my dad was dying, and they wanted us to say goodbye to him. But That wasn't communicated. So I just remember looking at him, being fearful, and leaving the room, and went home, and we just went about our day. Well, today, I know that that is the family disease of alcoholism. I'm a crier, sorry. When it's not communicated, we don't talk about what's going on. Nothing is discussed, you know. We're left to feel whatever it is that we're feeling and interpret things the way that we think what's happening. And so I recall that it was a rough time. We were taken to family members' house and everyone was helping out. But, you know, we'd stay with my aunts and cousins, and they were always so warm and loving to us. And everyone was helping us out. And then one day my dad started getting better. And he got better, and he got better, and they sent him home. And I remember my father coming home, and he had to learn to do everything again. He had to learn to walk and communicate and all of those things. But as he did that, my dad started changing. And, you know, he got some help for himself for whatever it is. I still don't know to this day. I could ask my mom, she can't really remember what happened. But I think that my dad's near-death experience changed him, and he stopped drinking without the use of any program. Maybe it was fear, I don't know. But for 26 years, my dad stayed sober, and that was a gift. Because prior to that, the father that that I knew was a very angry, violent man. He would, you know, punch holes in the walls. He would yell. He would scream. And I always remember my mother pushing us outside to go outside, go out and play. So, you know, we lived on the streets.
Thank you.
In the late 70s and early 80s, we lived on the streets, you know. It was a great time. You know, our parents didn't have trackers on us, but they trusted we were home, or, you know, we were in the neighborhood. I used to do a lot of things that I probably, you know, shouldn't have been doing. And, but, you know, the parents back then, they kind of neglected us, you know. Not every parent, because there were some parents on the street, you know, friends of mine, their parents were very loving parents, and I was always over there. I remember that I was just wanting to talk to somebody, and I was talking to my friend's parents because I knew something was wrong in my house, and I knew there was just nothing right. And I did that for a while in my teenage years. Those feelings followed me the rest of my life and until now. So when I was a teenager, of course, you know, I'm looking for someone to love me. I'm looking for someone to fulfill that emptiness inside me. And I, you know, I had a lot of boyfriends, and I just remember I was always looking for someone to fix, wanted someone to love me. And if they didn't fit that picture, I was going to make them, you know, love me. And I had my first boyfriend was a singer of a punk rock band, played guitar, and, you know, because I like those dangerous types, and he was fun, and about 3 months into our little silly dating, I noticed at the backyard parties, he was doing things, and, you know, I knew it wasn't right, but I didn't know what he was doing, but I didn't ask, and I didn't care. Why? Because I don't ask questions, you know? I didn't have a voice, and I was in denial about a lot of things back then. And I remember he, you know, I'd find out, oh, he's doing heroin. Oh, okay, no biggie. We can work with that. And so, and I, You know, and I maintained that relationship for a while, and about a year into our relationship, he told me, I have a serious problem, and my parents want me to go to a rehab. And I said, okay, you know, go ahead and go. And he went into program, and or he went into a rehab facility, and he was out for 30 days. And, you know, I couldn't wait. I had to have somebody, so I found another person. He got out, and he, you know, contacted me, and I said, you know, I'm moving on. And 2 weeks later, I get a call that he did a lethal dose of heroin and died. So that was my first experience with my first boyfriend died of a heroin overdose. And I was so naive to any addiction or alcoholism, you know. My father was an alcoholic, but, you know, this was just normal behaviors, you know, that I would see portrayed out there. And, you know, and so I found another hymn, and this hymn was, you know, not doing any of those things. He was good, you know, and so I knew I wanted to marry him, and I was going to do anything I needed to do to make sure that happened. So when we were, I was 18, he was 17. And I got pregnant, we got married, and you would have think I would have saw the signs that something was brewing, but I didn't. You know, on our wedding day, he disappeared for 2 hours. Don't know where he went. Still didn't ask questions, you know, because I live in denial. And I also live in not knowing how to communicate or ask what's going on, you know. It's easier for me not to know what's going on. We don't talk about feelings. I don't ask. And I gave birth to a daughter 31 years ago. And, you know, I thought we were going to just live this wonderful little life together. And 2 years into our marriage, you know, and mind you, those 2 years were rough. You know, there was always missing money. There was never enough for diapers. There was never enough for milk. You know, always looking to borrow money to pay rent, you know. And I was the responsible one. I don't know where his money's going, you know. They didn't have the internet. They didn't have Google. They didn't have GPS. So I had to find other means to find out what he was doing with this money. And it took 2 years, you know, because it got to the point where I had to press him where all this stuff was going. And so immediately, you know, he tells me he has a problem. And, you know, I went and made sure I got him into a rehab. This is what he does. You're going to go into rehab, and I'm going to send you to Florida rehab because the furthest thing from where we live here. And, you know, my control and managing started way back then. And he got well for a little bit and came back, and the same thing started to happen, you know. But I saw them, but it was easier to deny what was going on. And we did that dance for about 8 years, you know. And in those times, you know, I felt just like our readings in Al-Anon tell us, you know, alone, unloved. I felt all of those things through the marriage. You know, I was a single mother. I felt like a single mother, raising my daughter, and then eventually had a son. And about 8 years into that marriage, you know, I didn't know alcoholism and addiction is progressive. So it got to the point where there was abuse involved. And I filed for divorce. And it wasn't easy to even get to that place. I had to really, really go through some tough things, threats on my life, and never, you know, this big family that I'm talking about, you know, nobody knew what I was going through. No one knew the horrors that I was going through that my children were having to witness. You know, it wasn't easy to talk to anyone. And if I did, you know, they're just going to blame me. You know, that's the way I felt. You know, what am I doing to cause this, you know? and I had nothing to counteract those thoughts. But I knew I was going to divorce him and get away, so I did a geographical from LA County to Riverside County. I moved in with my sister, and I had my two children. And I can't be alone for a long time. I had to find another him, right? Because my value is in what I can give to you. And so I, you know, went to the Dodger Stadium, went to a family function, and 2 weeks before my divorce was final, and I met him, you know? And his name is Royal, and there was 100 seats at the Dodger Stadium that our family and cousins and everybody bought, and we were separated, but by the end of the night, we were sitting right next to each other. I don't know what it is about the Al-Anon and AA thing, but we're like magnets, right? So we find each other. I don't know. It just was magical for us. And, you know, wasn't looking for anyone, but, you know, it felt good. He knew I had two children. You know, let's try this thing. So I moved down to San Diego or Riverside and, you know, decided to try it again with this guy. And but this guy's different, right? Because this guy I know is in a program, because how he got to that Dodger Stadium was a brother-in-law who was divorced with my sister at the time. He was in recovery, and he brought his, you know, one of his friends along. And so, you know, that was, you know, it seems so long ago. It was in 2002. And my brother-in-law was a wonderful guy. And, you know, he stayed within our family, and we always knew he struggled. But I trusted him, and I trusted that he was going to be okay with me dating this guy, you know, his friend. And so we started this little romance, and we started playing instant family, and I had two children, and he was ready to take that challenge on. So we got married, and we lived, you know, this nice little, you know, life for about 2 years. And then we got married, and I got pregnant, and about 2 years in, here we go again. Same thing started happening. I knew he was in recovery, but there was a lot of secrets and hiding, and a lot of things I knew, I identified that we were disconnecting, and there was just a lot of uncomfortable situations happening. But I don't know how to confront that. I don't know how to talk to him. I had no communication skills. You know, my parents' conversations were always yelling at each other and in Spanish, so we didn't understand what was happening. That was their secret language. You know, they kept it from us. And so that's what I knew. I knew how to argue, yell. That was my conflict resolution. And so that's exactly what I did with my husband, you know. And they say that, you know, we bring baggage in, and I brought a lot of baggage into this marriage. And so I blamed myself. I blamed myself for his decline, you know, him not practicing the program. And so we did that dance for about 12 years. There were a lot of situations where I gave him those threats, you know, those threats that we tell them, you know, if you don't go get help, you know, I'm going to leave you. And I did that plenty of times. A few times he went to that brother-in-law's house, my brother-in-law's house, and he, you know, slept on their couch for a few days, and I eventually let him back in. And we just kept doing that merry-go-round dance that they talk about, and I didn't know how to get out of that. And we would have brief periods of recovery. He was doing his thing, and I didn't think I had any problems. You know, he's the problem. He needs to take care of himself. We will be okay. You know, that's the Al-Anon, you know, dance for me. It was his problem. So he, you know, in and out. We would have a good couple of years that went well. I knew he was working a program when he was taking the birthday cake, you know, to his meeting. He was still going to the meetings. He was still struggling, but, you know, there was really no serious change. It always went right back to the arguing, the lying, And I don't know what happened to me, but I started to disconnect. I started just being angry. I started being resentful. I started to blame him, blame myself, and be very angry with my children. My children got the brunt of it, because I had feelings. I just didn't know how to express them, but they got taken out of my children. So, for 12 years, we did that dance. And those 12 years, we tried everything that we could. You know, we went to church. We tried to do, so many different things, Bible study, and just nothing was changing. And we just kind of went right back to the same patterns, and I did that. And as we kept doing that, the arguments would get bigger. They would get worse. There was more things that were being broken. It started reminding me of the home that I grew up in, holes in the wall, yelling, and just ugliness. And at those times, he would have a sponsor, and I somehow got the sponsor's number, and I would text the sponsor, hey, he's not doing what he's supposed to, he's not behaving, he's tearing holes in the wall, and his sponsor would come and rescue and come over and do all the things that sponsors do, but I still didn't think I had a problem. I knew enough that I may have pissed him off and I may have poked the bear, but that's all I was doing. And so, it got really bad. It got really bad in the house. I noticed that at the time my children were, 21. My daughter went to college. She came back at 21. Then I had a 17-year-old son and then a 10-year-old daughter. And, I was in so much pain. But I couldn't see my pain. But I came into the rooms of Al-Anon because of my children's pain. Their pain was greater than mine, because I couldn't see mine. And so I remember one day we were arguing, and our 10-year-old daughter just said, "I just want to die." She wanted to die because she didn't want to see her parents arguing anymore. So that was the first indicator that, maybe I can do something. But I didn't know what to do. I just knew that there was something fundamentally wrong with our relationship. I couldn't get him sober. I couldn't get him to behave. I couldn't do all these things. And, I always grew up with a higher power. I grew up in my mom took us to church, and I really believe that I already had a communication with my higher power since I was a little girl. So even though I wasn't practicing the religion of my mom, that was still the God of my understanding. So I'd always pray to that God. And through our marriage, I just remember that I was in my prayer room one day, and I remember that my prayers changed from helping him to helping me. I needed to help myself, and I knew that I wasn't going to be able to do it alone. So one day I called one of his sponsors, another sponsor he had, and I was, letting him know what was going on once again with his, his guy here. And he said, I think you might need Al-Anon. And thank you, AA, for directing me to Al-Anon. It's funny how the circle of this program works. It was AA that brought me to Al-Anon. And mind you, my mother lived with me for 20 years. And she's lived with us for 20 years. And my mother attended Al-Anon meetings. And never once did she tell me that I needed Al-Anon. She lived with me. She saw what was going on in the home, I came from generations of that. My uncle, I remember, my uncle was the town drunk, and he was homeless, and he would push the cart. That was normal to me. I remember my mom would, he would come over, bring his cart. My mom would do all his laundry, feed him. He would take a shower, and he would go back out. And we did that. I being a little girl, I saw that for many years. That's just that. Well, that was normal to me. Then my uncle died on the streets, and and all those behaviors just that was just became my part of life. You know, that's just what happens. That is what's normal. You know, my marriage at 12 years into it, I didn't know where I stood in his life. I didn't know if we were going to get better, but I knew that something had to change. And I remember we just had this really, really rough time. I remember I was coming home from work, and I was already bracing, because as soon as I walked through that door, because we had technology now, right? I had bank statements, or I could see my banking on my phone, and I would see charges, you know, all the 7-Eleven stops and the Circle K. And I started to, you know, I would obsess about all these things that he's doing. So when I was coming home from work, I already had my guns drawn, and he was ready to, he knew. And he was ready and already defensive. So this was the household that we grew day to day. This is the way our lives were day to day. And like I shared, my daughter couldn't take it anymore. My older daughter had already moved out of the house. She escaped. If you talk to her today, she escaped that household. This disease takes hostages. The children are the hostages. Bill says that alcoholics come in through, like a tornado through the family, you know, in the crossfire. So, my children were my motivator. They got me in the rooms. Because I was them. They were me. You know, the things that, oh, I'm going to grow up, and when I grow up, I'm not going to let my children see that. And that's the first thing I did. You know, my two older children, I got to experience with their father, and then with their stepfather. You know, a mother's primary role is protection. And I didn't protect those kids. Now, had I known that, things would have been different. But I had to learn that only because of the grace of this program, my higher power, and my willingness to change, to listen to my heart, and to know that I wasn't without fault, that I was able to let my God start changing me. I'll share about what led up to me coming to Al-Anon. So I already had knowledge that I needed to go to Al-Anon. But, you know, I'm still trying to control and fight this guy, because that's what I do. You know, I'm going to fight him, and I'm going to keep trying to control, you know, that insanity. I'm going to control him, and I'm going to get him to, you know, to do this, and this, and then we're going to be okay. And, you know, that surrender, that first step, I don't know how to do that. You know, just like the alcoholic has to be beat into submission, I have to go through the same kind of thing, because my self-will tells me I can save you. I just got to love you enough, but I could save you, you know. My record showed that I couldn't do it with the first one, but I still think I can do it with this one, you know. That's how insidious this disease is. You know, both diseases. You know, one of the funny things that my husband and I can laugh today is he's sick and I'm sicker. You know, because all my behavior, I didn't have an ounce of alcohol in me or any kind of substance. You know, my craziness, my illness was just, you know, because of another person's behavior. You know, there's so many stories how God, in increments, started giving me awarenesses. I had little things that would happen, you know, you call them God shots or whatever, but it's a real thing. It really did happen. I can see them now. You know, all that pain that I went through with my first husband and then my current husband, you know, God hasn't wasted my hurt, you know, because I get to share it with you and help others. You know, the theme of our convention is to help in helping others and being in service. This is the highest service I can do, is be up here vulnerable and share what it was like in my home and how the gift of program, 12-step and Al-Anon brought us recovery. If there's a takeaway today, is that we do recover and there's a big God. You know, he's bigger than what I ever thought could happen to us. You know, those last weeks of us, I would say our demise, it was pretty rough. And how much time do I have? Okay, so I'll try to make this fast, because this is the change in my life, okay? Thank you. My husband, it was a rough week, like I said, and I went to my first Al-Anon meeting, because I was in crisis. My children were crying. I could see the pain. My daughter didn't want to be home. She was out in the streets. She was 10 years old. The neighborhood kid's mother taking care of her. And my older children were checked out. And, you know, in all those years, my oldest daughter started suffering with depression, anxiety. And I never took responsibility that anything that she was feeling was because of the household she grew up in. You know, I had no awareness that she was suffering still. So all these things that happened this week, I just was in that desperation. You know, I shared, I was crying, I was praying for something to change. And I kept praying for him, and then my prayers changed for me. And so I went to an Al-Anon meeting, and that was my first Al-Anon meeting. It was on a Wednesday night. And I went right after work. It was at 5:30, and I heard enough that it made me want to come back for more. So I went to the Saturday meeting and didn't know what to expect. And I didn't know that my higher power was guiding me, because he happened to put me in a room with several women who had so much wisdom and strength to share. Two of them were part of the 12-step panel. They just loved me. They loved me, and they shared wonderful things with me. And I was that person that was just crying and sharing how much my husband was hurting my life and hurting my children. And I remember one of them said, you know, shared about the dignity to fail. And, you know, after that meeting, I remember that meeting for that Saturday meeting, I thought, I wonder, were they talking to me? You know, were they talking to me? I'm not sure, but I think they were. But, you know, and I kept going back. And every week I heard more reasons why I needed to be there for myself. And so my husband, I remember, you know, I went for about 3 months before I made a move, because I had to be sure that this was the right thing to do, you know, because Al-Anon's, you know, we got to make sure, you know. And so I said, you know what, I think I need to ask him to leave. You know, I heard enough that I knew that I was accepting unacceptable behavior in my home. And I need to protect my children, and I'm going to ask him to leave. So I remember Saturday, I asked my older daughter to take the young daughter, get everybody out of the house. I'm going to ask my husband to leave. And so I got home from my meeting. Mind you, I don't suggest anyone do this, but I didn't have a sponsor at the time, and I thought it was a good idea to ask my husband to leave. I had no blueprint what to do, and I had no backup. You know, I hadn't even got to the story in the end of how Al-Anon works to know that I should have a backup plan. And so I asked him to leave. And once again, it turned into World War III in our home. And there were broken doors, and you know, he wasn't taking it very lightly. He didn't like me putting a boundary that I was done and that he needed to leave. So, you know, he threw a fit, and then we were throwing things at each other, and then I got scared. I got scared, and he had never hit me, and he had, you know, never roughed me up like that, but I was fearful. And so I called 911, and I call 911, I pick up the phone, they answer, and I hang up. And I said, okay, and then the phone rings. They call me back and say, did you call? And I said, no, and I hung up. You know, because I do not know how to tell them I need help. I don't know how to ask for help for myself. So, I get a knock at the door, you know. I hung up twice, thankful for the Marietta Police Department who send a cruiser to my house. They come to my door, they say, did you call the police? I guess, you know. I didn't even know how to say it, but I saw my husband standing behind me, because when we got in, when that argument, he knew that I was calling the police, he jetted out that front door, and he went down the street, and the police saw him and brought him to the house. And so the police comes in the house, and he says, you know, your husband said you guys got in a fight, and he says, can I come in? I said, sure. He looks around, he says, you know, are your kids here? I said, no. He said, well, you know, this is child abuse. Do you know that? He said, and if they were here right now, I would take them from you. You know, God did for me what I couldn't do for myself, because the proof was there, what was happening. And I had to get honest really quick. So he gave me a card, and he said, he asked me what was going on. I said, oh, I don't know. He's drunk, and he's loaded, and he's psychotic. I don't know what to do. And he says, take him to this place. So we got dressed after he left. He let him go. I don't know why he did that. The condition of our home was horrendous. We get dressed. We go drive out to, it's called the farm in Riverside. And we took him, and I was, thank God, you know, something's going to happen now, you know. And so we get him to his room, or we get him into the lobby, and we sit down. They call him back. And, you know, I'm just going along. I'm paralyzed in fear, and I don't even know what's going to happen. But I knew that whatever was happening, you know, this needs to continue to happen. And he comes back out, and I'm like, you know, he's like, let's go. And I'm like, what do you mean, let's go? They're not keeping you? Did they not see what's going on? And he says, look, no, they thought I was okay. So so we got in the car, and I told him, okay, well, but it took an hour to get in the car, because we, again, started arguing. And it took an hour to get him in the car. We get in the car and drive an hour back home. And in that hour, I had this revelation that, no, you can't come home. You know, the reason why we're here is because you can't come home. So he had a night bag with him, and I said, where do you want me to take you? And he says, drop me off at mom's. I said, okay, I'll drop you off at your mom's house. So I dropped him off at his mom's house, and I said goodbye. And I get in my car, and I leave. And five minutes later, I see the phone ring. And I knew better not to answer it, because I didn't recognize the number, but I answered it, and it was him. And come pick me up. My mom don't want me here. And so that was quick. And so I said, all right. I'm going to be the good Al-Anon. I'm going to go back and pick him up. I can't leave him on the streets. I just can't do it. So I pick him up, and here we go again. Right back to the same conversation. and he just wasn't getting it. So I said, you know what? I was just done, and I see a police cruiser in the Sam's Club parking lot. You know, our local Sam's Club. I said, I'm gonna tell them how you're behaving. I'm done with you. Mind you, we already had the police off, at our house earlier that day. And he called my bluff. He said, go ahead, go drive by them. What are you gonna do? So I said, okay. So I go drive and I go up to the police and I drove right around them and I chickened out. And something came over me. We get to the front of the entrance of the Sam's Club and something came over me. I don't know what it was, but I just needed to get out of the situation, quickly. And so I pulled my car, I put it on the brake, and I'm right in the front, and I said, get out of the car. And, we exchanged some words, and he said, okay, fine. He gets his stuff, and he goes to the back seat, and the door's open, and I punched it. And when I took off, I took his foot with me, and he went under my car, and he rolled a little bit, and he's here, guys, he's here. He's okay. And I remember he went rolling, and everyone goes and surrounds him, and they're trying to, see if he's okay, and he gets up, and he starts hobbling over to me. And this guy comes from behind me, and my window's down, and he said, ma'am, I saw what happened. I've been there, too. He said, but they called the cops on you. You better leave, And I said, okay, so we hear the paramedics, we hear the police department, and so he hobbles over and he said, you're going to jail. So I said, okay. And I said, get in the car. So he gets in the car, and we're like Bonnie and Clyde now because they're looking for us. And 10 minutes earlier, we were yelling expletives with one another, and now we're collaborating what we're going to do because the cops call. Or my daughter calls me and said, Mom, where are you? And I said, we're driving around. And she says, well, the cops are here at our house. So that person who called gave them my license, and, of course, they tracked it to me. Thank God for them. I don't know who they were, but thank you for doing that. And he was okay. We got to the house. The police, when my daughter called me, the police said, they wanted to talk to me. They confirmed it was me that ran over my husband, and they drove me to the, they wanted us to come talk to them, so we collaborated a little story, and he sobered up really quick, and when we got there, the police, they shined the light on me to see if I'm the one with the drinking problem. They check my husband, and then, they say, I don't know what's going on between you two, but something needs to change. And here is an opportunity to leave one another. You guys shouldn't be together. And so, sure enough, that's what I did. That next morning, I trusted that he'd spend the night. He stayed in the room that had the door missing. We decided, he was going to go back to his mom's house, whatever he needed to do. And for 14 months, we weren't together. And in that time, I know I don't have too much time, but in that time, I really got serious with my program. I started to I got a sponsor. I worked the 12 steps with her. She told me in that year, she said, I don't know what you're going to do with your husband, but why don't you wait a year before you make any decision? And so I did that. I didn't make any decision. I just worked on myself. I focused on myself. I went ahead and did the, all the things that she asked me to do. And then for 14 months, he was out of the house. And in those 14 months, it was a time that I was able to reconnect with my children. I was able to work my program. I actually opened myself to be vulnerable with them, to ask for their forgiveness, to start the healing process, because it's been a long process. I got into service work right away. My sponsor was Lead by Example. She did a lot of service, so I followed suit. I got into, about 2 years in, I got into Alateen service because I had a 12-year-old daughter, and there was no Alateen, and it was just one kid that needed it. So, you know, I felt called to do something about it. I went to my district. I asked, you know, what will it take to get an Alateen meeting? And she shared with me what it would take. And so I actively asked people if they were willing to become an AMIUS. We got a meeting going, and it took about 6 months to get everyone. We got about five women and one man, and we were able to get an Alateen registered meeting. But we had only one teen, which was my daughter. And then we got another one. And so you can have a meeting with two. We couldn't have one with one, but we were able to have one with two. And so we, those two teens went for weeks and weeks and weeks in 2019. And then COVID hit. And the Alateen program, we tried the Zoom with them, can't get them to come on Zoom. And so the Alateen program went dormant for 2 years. And in those 2 years, I stayed an AMIUS. I kept my registration because I knew something was going to happen after we got out of the pandemic. And in 2002, after my husband and I reconciled, we got a home together. We got a new, you know, everything. We started new. We built a new relationship. And even though it was very hard, it was like the two porcupines dancing. You know, we were both trying to do each other's programs without poking each other and trying to manage all these things that we were doing. But, you know, it was just beautiful that day by day, you know, we lived in the one day at a time, both of us. And I remember praying. I'm like, I don't even know, God, if I loved him anymore, you know, because I was just so angry and resentful. And then I just kept doing the steps. I kept being of service. And as I started to help those teens, when we got a new meeting started, you know, it was like, you build it, they will come.
Yeah.
And that started happening. And those, we started getting teens, and they were just coming out of everywhere. And then AA people were bringing their teens. It wasn't even Al-Anons anymore. AA fathers were dropping their kids off, you know, because he was sharing with at his meetings, you know, my wife got Alateen going on, you know. All the families affected. The families affected. My children were affected. And how I mend fences today is I show up for your kids. I can't bring healing to my kids anymore. You know, I can't go back to their childhood. But I can do it today with your kids. Those kids are beautiful. I have a teenager right now that she just came on Tuesday. She comes, she struggles, she comes, but in 2 years, you know, she has been coming, and she came in so angry and was hurting herself, hurting her mother, just was so full of anger. And she came in on Tuesday, and we read these dialogues, and one of the questions was, why do you come to Alateen? And she said, I come to Alateen because I was affected by alcoholism and I want to get better. And she is 8 months pregnant, and she's turning 18 years old, and she's still coming to Alateen. And she said, you know, as soon as I turn 18, I want to start an Al-Anon meeting for my group, you know. And we've had two teenagers grow out of Alateen already. And and one of the boys, I just found out yesterday that he's going to seminary. You know, he was going since he was 9 years old. He was allowed to go to a meeting in Lake Elsinore or Corona area. And the reason why I had started this meeting is because I heard there was a boy who needed Alateen. So I started it, you know, and I started it in our area, but then his mom started to come and bring him. And that's how we started getting more teens and more teens, you know. And unfortunately, I couldn't always be in there because if my daughter came, I couldn't be in those rooms. And eventually, those five AMIUSes turned to 10. We have 13 right now. Currently, we're in the school, Temecula School District.
Right.
Temecula opened their doors by default because there was a child whose parent died of a DUI, or he was drunk driving and he died. And we came in the back door and the school opened up to have Alateen meetings. And so now we have two meetings. We have 13 Amiuses. We're looking to grow another meeting. You know, if you build it, they will come. That's exactly what we did. It just took one. It just took one. You know, it just had to take one God idea. You know, and that's the gift that I could give back. I can't go back and save my kids. I wish I could. My older daughter is still very, she's still angry. She's still resentful. But that's okay. Every time I see her, I just love her. I just love her. I couldn't do it before. You know, I can listen to her now. I could acknowledge her pain. I could acknowledge her hurt. I don't know that woman she talks about, because that's not who I am today. But I got to redo. You know, I have a daughter right now, and I feel that God gave me a chance to be a different mother. And I did, you know, and I got a text message from my daughter this morning, how much she loved me and how much she just hopes we just have a wonderful time. You know, I know Lois, you know, she always, I read that she saw Al-Anon, AA, and Alateen. That was the three A's, she called it, or something like that. So, you know, that's one thing that my husband and I do. We share the gift of recovery. We share that it's not just the parents, you know, it's just not us. You know, there's kids, and those were the hostages, you know, that got caught in the crossfire. So I just wanted to end in this. You know, when I first came in, there was a lady who, you know, you think you know, you come in with so much information you need to read on, you know, Al-Anon and so much Cal literature, and something so simple I identified it with, and it was in the Alcoholism, the Family Disease, and it says, it's the first part, quoted from Bill. It says, any family, wife, and children who have had to live with an alcoholic a number of years are bound to be rather neurotic and distorted themselves. They can't help it. Thank you for letting me share.